Blind Nil Audio.
Today on 50 Fires, my conversation with Matt Higgins.
Believe it or not, I've done a million podcasts, but not specifically about money.
As an investor, author, and frequent shark on Shark Tank, Matt has achieved a lot.
So I've gone through the entire journey, right? Coming from nothing, actually coming into money.
But his definition of what he wants money to mean in his life will surprise you.
You can use money in a very intelligent, calculated, nuanced way to make a maximum impact on a specific problem. Apply your creativity and entrepreneurial energy to get much more out of that money than simply making a donation to a 501c3.
That's today on 50 Fires. Greetings, Carl here. My guest, Matt Higgins, has been super successful. As the co-founder and CEO of RSE Ventures, a private investment firm that focuses on sports, entertainment, media, and technology, he served as vice chair of the Miami Dolphins, and you may have seen him as one of the sharks on Shark Tank. But it's been quite a journey to get there, because as you'll hear in this episode, and as he outlined in his book, Burn the Boats, he grew up in poverty in New York City. And that created a large part of the framework through which he views money. So let's get into it. I'm Carl Richards, an artist, an author, and a proud financial advisor. And this is 50 Fires. Today, we're talking about money with Matt Higgins. Well, what did they tell you? How did they convince you to be on this?
I love Chip and Joanna. Number one. Number two, I believe it or not, I've done a million podcasts, but not specifically about money. And I just think about it all the time and have takes on it. And it was no convincing. It was a nanosecond. So
most of us were taught never to talk about politics, sex, money, or religion. Like in your household, which I've read a bit about, what was your earliest memory of the topic of money?
My earliest memories, interesting, yeah. We had nothing, right? And literally grew up eating government cheese, which actually said brought to you by the USDA. But my mother, for whatever reason, had this abundance mindset, completely unjustified. She'd always say, if you let money go free, it'll come back to you. There was no evidence in our house that that was the case. But they definitely weirdly grew up with my mom being dirt poor, but feeling like indulgence mattered around the margins. And so the indulgence for us was ham. And you remember those direct-to-consumer steak meat companies, Omaha Steaks?
Yeah.
Omaha Steaks was like our indulgence. And so it was always confronted with these different, mindsets of abundance when there was no evidence of it.
Did your mother actually say the words, if you let money go free,
it'll come back?
That was something you remember her saying.
I do, because there was no evidence of it. And I remember my mom always prioritizing soothing in some way. And in little ways, in ways we couldn't afford. I'll give you an example. The last thing she had when she died, and I had to go through her passbook, was a Christmas savings passbook from Dime Savings Bank. I still remember, you get the little book and it had the interest rate stamped on it. And the only thing she had in the world was a few hundred dollars that was saved up for Christmas. There was just this, like, to the very end, a desire to use whatever marginal dollars we had for a degree of soothing and the feeling that it's going to come back to us.
I love that statement. I've thought a lot about money's natural state being flow, right? We have all sorts of words for that, like currency, cash flow, money coming in, coming out. We've got some of the wisdom traditions of like saying, look, money's meant to be in flow. And if you dam it up, right, it becomes stagnant, like energy. Like there's lots of metaphors that way. Like, what do you make of that? Of your mother, not necessarily your mother saying it, but just that idea that if you set money free, it will come back to you. What do you make of that now?
A few things. I'd say my first money lesson was at the casino, scared money never wins. And I've come to believe that is actually 100% true, even though probably not necessarily at the casino table. So I've gone through the entire journey, right? Coming from nothing, actually coming into money. But actually the most important adult lesson I had is when I actually had some liquidity. And my relationship with money pivoted from having this paranoid mindset, fear that I'm going to end up at housing court being evicted, to relating to money in my capacity to lose it, to handle the loss. And it actually was very corrupting. Huh. It was actually, I made some of the worst decisions I've ever made in my life when I had liquidity. Anybody out there who's won the lotto understands this, but it's because, and I started meditating, like, where'd my judgment go? And I realized, actually, I respected the dollar because of what it meant in terms of what I was defending against, which was going back in time to housing court and powerlessness. So money represented autonomy and freedom and emancipation for me. When I had money, money now, because I really didn't care that much about it other than as a means for securing an independence, I then related to money with my capacity to lose it.
Wow.
And I realize now, because I would judge people who try to get richer, I'm like, why are they bothering? Aside from the psychic, you know, game. And I realized the only way to stay wealthy is to try to get wealthier. That money's like humans, you know, only helicopters hover, right? We're either progressing or regressing or descending or ascending. And that once you have money, you have to continue to relate to money for the intrinsic value that it has, divorced from your capacity to lose it.
$1,000. Hey, it's Carl here. Did you feel that? Because I felt a little uncertain and, to be honest, unsure or unmoored at this part of the conversation. Matt's statement that the only way to stay wealthy is to focus on being wealthier, I'm not sure I agree. But here's the thing. I have had thousands of conversations with people about money, and I found that we all build frameworks, mental models, ways for thinking about money that work for us. And that's exactly what Matt's done. And I have no doubt, based on the rest of the conversation and what I know about Matt, that this model works for him. But that does not mean it needs to work for you. So my question is, how did you feel? Pay attention. It's okay. In fact, one of my goals of this podcast is to ask questions that I do not have the answer for. But you know who has the answer for how you feel about money? It's you. You can trust yourself as you navigate this complex relationship with money. So first of all, I just want to understand where you referenced housing court twice.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that's coming from experience. Like, where did that fear come from?
Yeah. So we were, you know, people use these words, abject poverty, and they lose their resonance, right? But like, we were so desperately poor and every bit of dysfunction that comes with it. So we didn't have healthcare. And so I spent my early days in an ER pretending to have meningitis because that was the hack. Oh, I have a stiff neck. And then mom'd be like, just pretend you have a stiff neck. I've had more cases of meningitis in New York City than probably anyone ever. And so no healthcare. No food, selling flowers on street corners starting when I was 10 years old. I would be the little kid knocking on your door, guilting you into buying your girlfriend flowers, like selling scalping tickets, waiting online for scalpers all night long. And then they'd pay me for waiting online. Like, I'm just painting a picture. So desperation, frustration, and then eviction notices and end up being in housing court. Remember my mom pleading with the judge, the little notices from Con Edison. I don't know if they still do this, but they'd shut off your power. And then the notice from the marshal on your door, you know, like these notices. And I don't, to this day, I won't open mail. I've never said this before. This sounds completely nuts. I can't believe I just said that. I will not open mail. When my wife and I first started dating, she's like, what's all this mail? I was like, mail represents remittance notices to me. So I just better not open mail. So I don't open mail. You know, it just, you know what? You get older, you get to make little choices. And so that's one of my choices.
It's so interesting because when we had some trouble in 2008, I remember trying to get home before the mail got dropped off so that my wife wouldn't see it.
Oh, that's so interesting.
You know, like trying to like intercept it. I was like, I thought my job was to kind of protect them from this stress of the housing struggle we were having we were in Vegas in 2008. That sort of gives you a sense of what may have happened. And
oh, wow.
I remember getting home like, oh no, I got to get that FedEx package before my wife or kids see it.
So you understand. I mean, so just the other day I went to the house and there's a pile of mail. She has her system and I started looking through it and I was like, and I started throwing them away. She's like, what are you doing? I was like, can't be anything good. You know?
Where do you, I mean, just super curious now, like, go to that pile of, where do you feel it?
I have come full circle in this area. And I talk a lot in my book, Burn the Boats, about trauma. I think when I was very young, I was more judgmental of people like, get over it already. Look at me. I'm the mayor's press secretary. I'm 26 and I'm going to law school at night. Mom died. I'm still a fighter, right? Papering over, you know, like sedimentary rock trying to bury it. And then I got to a certain point, life does bring you to your knees. Usually it's a catalyst. For me, it was some of the things I went through on the personal home front, getting divorced, having cancer. And so my point is, I'm very respectful of the lingering trauma and the flashing amygdala. Where I feel it is primal. It is a reflexive reaction. I immediately go back in time. I remember the because remember the letters always had the red color, right? Everything's trying to get your attention and trigger you. So I feel it very viscerally, but I also feel it in a sense of rebellion. Like, you know what? I don't have to read the mail anymore.
Right.
I can check this whole pile away and you'll probably send me another notice. But this is so far. I've never talked about this before, about how that lingers with you. And I like talking about it because the young Matt Higgins would try to, you know, power through things. And at my age, I feel like it's more of a gift to share people things like that, because they're like, oh, you still feel that way? Because I still feel that way.
Hey, it's Carl. If you're like me, I imagine you've always believed that money was about spreadsheets and calculators. If it was in a department in school, it was in the math department. And here we have Matt Higgins talking about things like feelings, using words like primal and visceral. So one thing that I found incredibly valuable is to notice, just pay attention to how I feel when I'm talking about money, especially with a spouse or partner. Where do I feel it? If it was a color, this is one of my favorite questions. If it was a color, what color would it be? Because as we notice that feeling, we can start to put a little space between the feeling and our immediate reaction.
I still carry this. One of the hardest things anyone out there who's achieved a degree of wealth knows that most of it's paper. Most of it's just debt. It's like the right to control something, not necessarily own something. Like, it's an illusion, right? All your assets. And so actually trying to calibrate, am I safe, is even something that I still struggle with, because I like to take risks and I want to take risks and I want to resist the impulse. And I still can't tell whether or not this is a rational response or not. And you know, the thing that freaks me out the most, it's not the recession that's coming. It's not 2008. It's not macro things. In fact, when things go bad, I feel a little more peaceful, because the things I was worried about now materialized. One less thing to worry about. It's happened.
Get it out of the way.
Yeah. Right. It's when my judgment is compromised that I get very, very, very vulnerable. Because if I lose my judgment, I can't protect the kids. And then I feel like I'm not a good steward and somebody should take the keys away. During crypto, when I made some really breathlessly stupid decisions, that actually scared me more than the loss of the money, was the loss of the judgment and being like, you don't deserve to be a steward of this family's money. And so I'm still, to this day, trying to calibrate, like, am I safe? Is this rational? Because of judgment. Anybody could lose their judgment.
Man, talk to me a bit about, so two words that I really want to talk about, like, am I safe? Like, what are you pointing at there? How do you think about that? What does that mean to you to ask the question, am I safe?
Such a good question. Well, I think it is subjective for everybody, because then the question is safe from what? So safe from me is safe from subjugation. My entire upbringing was it's like the five stages of grief, but more like the five stages of disillusionment. And now I'm on this desperate campaign to transcend my circumstances, making radical decisions. I drop out of high school at 16 so I can take my G to get into college, go from making $375 an hour at McDonald's to making $100,000 a year in a decade as the mayor's press secretary. And then my mother dies that morning. So like, my biggest takeaway was, my instincts told me that this was an exigent crisis for which no one was responding to. And I was like, why are you allowing this little boy to take on the responsibility? And I learned something about society and humanity. People will allow someone else to shoulder the load if you let them. And that doesn't make me disillusioned. It just makes me know that I have to be an agent in my own rescue, and the cavalry's never coming. So I feel this tremendous weight. So am I safe? Am I safe from what? Am I safe from subjugation and dependence? I do not want to be subjugated, and I don't want to be dependent. And the only way I could do that, I meditated on this a long time, is come up with a new definition for FU money. I don't know if we're allowed to curse here, so I'll just say FU money. And what I decided was, like, I don't seek to go to the Cayman Islands or drink pina coladas. That's like not my definition of winning. I seek independence, and I seek enough runway to allow me to rebuild from either my own bad judgment or from apocalyptic circumstances. And so the answer is, do I have 3 years of liquidity to be able to meet my kids.
Don't do it. I know. I feel the same way. As soon as I hear a number like 3 years, I want to debate the merit of the number and I miss the point. The point here is amazing. What's your definition of safe? And then how could you operationalize it in your life? That's amazing.
Do I have 3 years of liquidity to be able to meet my kids' needs, handle my ambition, all these things, and rebuild from any calamity? So the long story is, like, am I safe? Do I have enough to be free from subjugation and dependence?
Do you feel like money does that job?
100%.
You mean, like, you feel like 3 years, for instance, just to pick a number, and then you feel safe?
I really do. And for the longest time, you know, I did some therapy and I tried to work through it. And therapy is amazing. And I've worked on healing, but a couple of things, I think somehow you have to sort of take yourself as you come. So in some cases, it's not that the die is cast, but the book is written a bit. And rather than try to rewrite the book, just be like, all right, this is the base case of Matt Higgins. You went through this unrelenting trauma. And for you to feel at your best, you need that. So rather than resist it and try to get somebody to talk you out of it, how about I meet the need, right? And for me, it does make it work. And it's actually pretty rational at the number is three. Think about it, 10,000 hours to form a new habit. You can achieve that in 3 years. You can get a master's degree in 3 years. The average person can learn a language in 12 months. Like in 3 years, I can launch a business and stabilize it. And so actually money... People always say, oh, money doesn't solve all your problems. Yeah, but money solves the absence of money problems, and that is a lot of problems. And the problem is the absence of money problems eclipse all other problems, right? So I am a big believer that money does do that for you. It did it for me.
Yeah, so tell me, because I'm super curious about, because you pointed to some work you've done therapy-wise, because we all know people, you definitely know people, who no amount of money will ever be enough. They're insecure, and I've said this often, like if you are insecure with money, more money won't solve that problem.
So true.
It's a different set of work. And so I'm curious about the role, like what do you, first of all, you know, you've done some other work to allow this, and I'm just going to keep using the three-year rule, which is, it's fine. Like one thing that's really interesting, I find this often in these conversations about money is, as soon as you put a number on something or you use a word like three, people want to debate the merits of that.
That's right. Tear it apart. Yeah.
Like, don't worry about the three. But just as a stake in the ground, you've done some other work to allow the three-year thing to actually work in your life. And maybe the easier way to ask the question is, we all know people who have more money than they'll ever need and they're totally insecure. What do you make of that?
It's a great question. For me, it goes back to, if I have narrowly defined the object of the exercise about am I safe to be free from subjugation and dependence, right? So money is a means to achieve it. That's my relationship with money. Money is not a means for prestige. I think it's, honestly, I judge it. I think it's kind of pathetic if somebody derives prestige from it. Money is...
So judgy.
Right. I know. But I'm being honest. I love it. Money is a means of exchange. Money buys units of autonomy for me. That is the number one thing money can buy. And then it buys then empowerment. You know what I mean? It buys a catalyst, however I choose to apply the catalyst. And then it buys soothing and indulgence. Right. Yeah. And so for me, that's why more money is not the object of the exercise. Once you start running up the score, for me, money becomes about, it's just the way people keep score of some version of success. But back to your point about, I 100% think those who, you know, need more and more, they are trying to solve the insecurity problem because they become a prisoner in the game, right? Of manifesting stature through nice watches. And so I'm just grateful I don't have it. I really don't have it because, again, I have that framework.
Yeah. Let's go back a bit to steward and stewardship. Like, when did you start using that word and how do you think about it?
It really came into mind during the crypto period when I felt like that two things collided. I had a lot of liquidity. I had extra time like everybody else. And then I compromised on bedrock rules. And then I realized that I was doing it because I had the capacity to lose it. And then I started, that threatened my identity around being a steward. Like, I'm on a mission. I'm here to take care of these children. I got to deliver them a life that I didn't have. That is my number one anxiety. And then feeling like I'm a steward. All these people are trusting me to make great decisions. I have all this latitude in my life to deploy that capital. And look what you did. And so that's where the word steward came in. I have to preside over this, you know, corpus of capital, so to speak, and make sure that it's ready to be deployed for the purpose. Number one, taking care of those kids, right? And number two, securing those units of autonomy. And so that's where steward came in, is me coming up at the edge of feeling like I was threatening the estate, so to speak.
Mm. Is there any wisdom, tradition, spirituality, or religion that you drew some of your beliefs around money from?
Yes, it actually stems back to what I witnessed as a kid with my mother slowly degrading and a lot of the apathy. I think people who go through a degree of trauma can have two fundamental responses. One is to feel resentful or bitter or angry about that which was denied to you, and you are therefore going to deny it to others. Mm. I didn't have this. You know what I mean? And those parents who try to prosthetically install hardship into their kids' otherwise middle-class life, I think are making that decision, right? Or there's someone who says, wow, I was denied this. And if it had been supplied, it would have done so much to my life or changed the trajectory of someone else's life. I am going to take away from this the desire to supply it for another. And so it's a long way of saying, I witnessed powerlessness and suffering. And if somebody had just cared an ounce, my mother would not have died. Like a human life would not have left this earth. A little boy would not have spent a decade and oftentimes being self-destructive, wishing to crash that car into a tree so that I could go into the hospital and somebody else could take responsibility. Mm. Like the consequences of powerlessness are so dramatic. A long way of saying what I really want to do on this earth in terms of a means of exchange, my hierarchy of how money is a means of exchange. Once I transcend autonomy, units of time, then money is a tremendous tool to ameliorate suffering. Not that I'm Mother Teresa, you know, and I have my own, you know, bad habits too, but like it really is, that is the highest and best use of money, power, time, and influence, but money in particular. So that gets me excited, you know, and that is what's going to propel me now from this point forward, because I've achieved those 3 years, right? I now have that. Now that's what drives me forward. So is that spiritual? I guess it's spiritual. I think it's actually practical. The highest and best use of money is to ameliorate somebody else's pain.
Does that relate back to set money free and it will come back, or is it not related in your mind at all?
Yeah, I think she was right, by the way, ironically. You know, it's so funny we're talking right now. I joked that there was no evidence of it, but the truth is you do need to trust that it'll come back. It is a little bit like burn the boats, right? Like if I fully commit to the deployment of this money, then it will come back to me. However, hope is the devil as it pertains to money, right? So I always am audit my decision-making. So I'm like, is there a calculated thesis here, or is this hope? You know, am I gambling or am I investing? And I'm constantly, you know, toggling and analyzing. So if you had the view that if you let money come free, it'll come back to you, you know, yes, but if your decisions are based upon calculated risks as opposed to, you know, hope. And I think a lot of my mom said that, frankly, she was justifying soothing, how you can use money for soothing.
Yeah. I'm just really interested in that subject because there's a juvenile version of the law of attraction, you know, which we see paraded around in the kind of financial pornography networks sometimes. And it may or may not have been featured in a really prominent book around it being a secret or something. And the problem with the juvenile version, I think you're pointing to, like hope, you know, just like if I just go buy the Benz,
right,
suddenly my listings will go up and I'll be able to pay for the bet. Like that's an interesting way of approaching the law of attraction, but there's something really true, and all the wisdom traditions have pointed at it, like to the idea of not being grasping, you know, not being desperate, and realizing that money's natural state is flow, and that if you set it free under the right circumstances, you set it free, it does come back. And there, you know, what Jesus said was, right, like, why are you worried about tomorrow? Look at the lilies. They're not worried about anything.
I love that lilies example. I'm going to go look that up. I'm definitely an aspiring Buddhist who never quite gets there, even though I know all I need to do is wake up to this moment, but I still struggle.
That's right. That seems like it's kind of hard.
Even though I know it is true.
We'll be right back with more from 50 Fires.
Hey, it's Carl. You know what's hard for most of us? Talking money. That's what I'm talking about.
talking about money is hard for most of us, but there's somebody who it is not hard for. She's been doing it forever. Her name is Shauna Game. And if you've been enjoying the conversations I'm having here at 50 Fires, I think you would love what Shauna's got going on at her podcast. The podcast is called Everyone's Talkin' Money. And just like 50 Fires, Shauna's goal with Everyone's Talkin' Money is to go beyond the spreadsheets and the calculators and the budgeting apps to talk about how our emotional relationship with money impacts our lives. With over 900 episodes, that's right, 900, there is an episode for any and every practical money question you have. Some of Shauna's recent episodes include retirement risks to avoid and credit card versus debit card. Which one should I use? You're going to love it. Subscribe to Everyone's Talkin' Money on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to 50 Fires. I read about your experience at Queens College. It made me wonder, were you aware of this socioeconomic class you were in? Like, were you aware of your financial situation when you were 14?
Yeah, I was aware of it from the time I was, I think you had kids pick up on the dysfunction first, because a kid, I think we instinctively know what is unnatural.
Yeah.
Like, right, kids get a sense when they're threatened, when somebody's being inappropriate. You also get a sense when there's a disequilibrium in your relationship to your parents. When you start handling adult problems and you are being required to handle them, or you being exposed to them, I think that's your first recognition. And then two, back then, it's funny, my kids now, they have wealth shaming. They have to hide wealth. Back then, we had to hide my poverty. So being around the other kids and being made fun of as a little kid was probably the other way. But I was, not only was I aware of it, I, one, felt responsible to change it. Because I think it's funny, if I was sitting on a therapist couch, which apparently I am because the way you talk, if I was sitting on a therapist couch, I would say to you that I was given the hero narrative, not that I earned it or meant to have it. I was given it as a means to make me responsible to save my mother, right? If we were to do it very, you know, deconstructed this in a very mythological way. But as a result, I always felt responsible to sell those flowers to get us out of poverty. And so I was very aware.
You just mentioned your kids and how they're in the opposite situation. This, I think, did you use the word wealth shaming?
Yeah. These kids these days, they have to hide any wealth. Isn't that funny?
Talk to me about that. Like, what have you seen or noticed? Or
no, they just do. I mean, the older ones in my family, my stepkids, they're older, and they would talk about that all the time, that, you know, they have to play it down. But then I'm like, well, how does that reconcile with Kim Kardashian and everything you see on the Instagram and the flexes? Like, it's a strange, they aspire to the materialism that they're subjected to, but then they can't actually look like they're trying to show it. I guess that's the point, right? Whereas back when I was a kid, like, you had to do everything to wear the right jeans so that nobody would, you know, beat the crap out of you for being poor. So I just laugh that I did all this work. And now we're going to, not that I care. If they were walking around acting like they had it, it would also make me nauseous. So it's just fascinating, the cultural moray.
Is that a term you just, like, have you heard the kids use this term, wealth shaming?
Yeah, they would say wealth shaming. Yeah, we can't put this on the ground because we'll be wealth shamed. Like, one of the problems with me going on Shark Tank was that it then telegraphs that presumably you have a degree of money, right? And that was something to be reconciled inside the family.
Yeah, so fascinating to navigate all of that. Like, even the use of the word privilege is so challenging.
Yeah, people get real mad. I think nobody wants to be told they have benefited from privilege. No one, even those who feel privileged, don't feel it, because everyone has something in their life that feels like a heavy burden.
Yeah.
I think what we're locking into is the path for us to all find common understanding without invalidating somebody's own journey and the work they put in to overcome their own adversity, while at the same time approaching with empathy what it would be like to carry that baggage.
What do you, it's so interesting to me, the role that money plays in those like perceived and real differences in power and opportunity. And like, how do you address that in your own mind? This has come up a couple of times in the, on this podcast. Like, we've had a bunch of people on that care deeply about the world and injustice and things that they see, and they care about it when they drive home to their safe, secure house, and navigating that conflict between, like, I'm going to use the word specifically, I think, like the privilege of that relative to the difference they want to make. Like, how do you organize and think about that?
Yeah, it doesn't bother me only because I always think about on the airplane, put your mask on first before assisting other passengers. Mm. So it's like, mm-hmm. I'm not effective unless I put my mask on. Now, you may judge my mask. You may think you may want to cap the amount I should need. Whatever it is that's the equivalent of that oxygen mask for me, I need to do first, number one. Number two, I feel a bit, I talk to my wife about this all the time. I'm always honest, but I was like, I feel like a hypocrite. I'm talking publicly about helping, and yet I also believe that in my hands, I'm going to be able to generate enormous wealth that is going to do enormous things for society. And so I can only do the best I can. I can grab on, I can do what I want simultaneously, concurrently while I accumulate. But I do have a vision that in the end, in my hands, it'll compound faster and more. And I just have to be, you know, reconciled to that. And in terms of—
Hey, it's me again. Have you ever felt that way? This hypocrisy around the way you handle money? I loved Matt's honesty here and the idea that he paints this tension that he says he needs to be reconciled with. And I think what he means about reconciled with is he's not trying to reconcile the tension. He just needs to be reconciled with the idea that that tension exists. And I think that's an incredibly important thing to remember. Our use of capital is always about trade-offs. Unless you have more capital than you need, there are always more demands than there is resources. So we're making intentional, and that's the key, is to make them intentional. We're making decisions about trading off. Do I spend that time or that money with my child? Or do I go to the volunteer program? Do I go to work or do I stay home? Like, it's always a set of trade-offs. And there is no getting rid of those trade-offs. So the sooner we can learn to live in that tension and be open and honest about our own hypocrisy, the better.
And in terms of where my heart goes, my favorite movie ever made, and I watched it all the time, I just watched it last week, is Schindler's List. I probably watched Schindler's List at least 20 times. My wife is like, isn't that a little bit morbid watching Schindler's List? I was like, it is the most important movie ever made. And I always watch it. I watch it to get to the last scene. In the last scene, he is giving a speech in the factory, and he finally allows himself to feel the enormity of what he did, and totally flawed character redeemed by the end. And he remembers he has a pin on, and it's a gold pin, and that gold pin could have been another life. And he starts going through the car. The car was two lives. And like, I do feel like in my heart, that is the essence of money in the end, after you put your oxygen mask on. And so I have to calibrate when to do it, how much to do it. But I am 100% convinced that that last scene in Schindler's List is the whole object of the exercise about money.
That's so beautiful. I almost want to just say amen there. But my last question, how many kids do you have?
I have four.
How old's the youngest?
15.
Imagine 20 years from now, I'm still doing the show and she's 35 and she comes on and we have a little conversation. What would you hope she would say about her relationship with money?
I'm going to use my son.
Sure.
Because my little one's on the spectrum. She's so cute. I can imagine what that conversation would be like. But let me use my son. I give you a more nuanced answer.
Yeah.
Actually, I'll give you the answer I'd want her to say. That my dad used that money to give me a great life. I can imagine what it would have been like if we didn't have it. And then he used that money to ameliorate suffering in such extraordinary ways. And I got to witness the power of money what money can really do through the example my dad set with his life, and not in terms of writing a check from the distance, but actually moving the needle in very big ways. And it always stuck with me that there's two ways you can use, not multiple ways, but you could use money and your influence and power. You could try to write the check to maybe soothe the soul and check the box, you know? Or you can use money in a very intelligent, calculated, nuanced way to make a maximum impact on a specific problem. Apply your creativity and entrepreneurial energy to get much more out of that money than simply making a donation to a 501c3. And so I hope when you're sitting here talking, you know, to my kids and 20 years from now, they're like, wow, Dad did some really creative things with that money. That it wasn't just about money. It was about him using his passion and his entrepreneurial energy to unlock something that wouldn't have happened. And I don't know what that is. I hope it's about human rights or you know, fighting subjugation somehow, somewhere in the world. But I hope it isn't just about Dad wrote some checks. Mm. And anybody can do that. Dad wrote smart checks.
Matt Higgins, thanks, my friend. That was so fun.
Thank you so much. I love this conversation.
Yeah, cheers. I often wonder if it's all worth it. This idea of having an examined life when it comes to your relationship with money, it can be tiring because this conversation with Matt was exhilarating. Don't get me wrong. I would have a conversation like this every day, but I go home from these conversations and I'm done for the day because thinking about this can be heavy, right? Thinking about the trade-offs and the hypocrisy. But my friends, like, I know no other way to get clear about it, right? We could go through life with our eyes closed if we want, just reacting to the things we see on the TikTok or the Instagram or what our neighbors are doing with money or how we feel about it based on something that happened maybe to our parents or our grandparents. Or we can be intentional about it. We can start to notice the feelings we have, things that might feel primal or just responsive. We can ask ourselves questions like, what does it mean for me to be safe? I know it would be so much easier if there was just a checklist. Just a checklist. But we've tried the checklists. The problem is they don't apply to us each individually. So the questions are personal. In fact, my friend Tim Maurer often says, personal finance is more personal than it is finance. And this conversation with Matt Higgins was a great example of it. So take a minute. Like, what would it mean for you to feel safe? What are the stories from your childhood that are showing up in your relationship with your spouse or your own kids? How can we just be a little more honest about our own hypocrisy? A little less judgment around money, a little less shame, a little less blame will go a long ways. Cheers, my friends. Until next time, this has been 50 Fires with Matt Higgins. 50 Fires is a production of Blind Nil Audio in association with The Roost. My friends, if you find this show valuable, share it with a friend and leave a 6 or 7 star review on Apple Podcasts. It's crazy how much that helps the show get introduced to larger audiences. I'm Carl Richards. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you around the fire for our next episode.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in this series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Blind Nil Audio, nor Magnolia.